This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We have worked very closely with President Mahama during his tenure, and if he is reelected, we will continue to work with him. And we have worked closely with Nana when he was foreign minister of the country and in previous capacities as the Minister of Justice. And if he should win the election, we look forward to working closely with him as well.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield speaking on Ghana's upcoming presidential election tomorrow. We'll have a full report from Accra coming up. Also, Libya's Misrata militia report they have defeated the Islamic State fighters in the only major stronghold held by the militants outside of Syria and Iraq. And UN Women and other groups are using this month to call for an end to violence against women. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, after 7 months of heavy fighting in the streets of Sirte, Libya's Misrata militia reports it has defeated Islamic State fighters. Sirte was the only major stronghold held by the militants outside of Syria and Iraq. A spokesman for the pro-government forces in Tripoli says the Islamic State forces have totally collapsed. He says extremists remain in only a few houses. More than 6,000 Islamic State fighters controlled the coastal city when the Misrata-based forces began their attack in June. More than 700 Libyan fighters were killed and 3,200 wounded by landmines, sniper fire, and suicide bombings in the house-to-house fighting. They were aided by U.S. forces that conducted more than 490 airstrikes in recent weeks. Ghana holds its presidential and parliamentary elections tomorrow. President John Mahama is facing a strong challenge from opposition leader Nana Akufo-Addo. Mahama says he is cautiously optimistic about winning another term, but says if he loses, he will hand over power and leave. VOA's Peter Cloti is in Accra and following election developments. He told Joe DiCapua the election will probably be a very close contest.
Yes, indeed. It's expected to be one of the most competitive elections since Ghana introduced constitutional rule in 1992. This year, particularly, the main opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, has made significant inroads into otherwise solid areas that supported the National Democratic Congress, which is the ruling party. They were able to have some significant campaigns in those areas. And I went around to ask them, they were saying it was time for change and that the National Democratic Congress has been in power for the last 8 years. They want to maintain the tradition of changing government every 8 years. But it remains to be seen because the National Democratic Congress held its last campaign rally at the Accra Sports Stadium yesterday, and it was massive. Now, you had a similar crowd of the New Patriotic Party having theirs to at the trade fair site the day before, and it was also massively attended, Joe.
So, Peter, the voters say they want change. Were they specific? What type of changes do they want?
What they want is a change in government, because although the ruling party, the National Democratic Congress of the NDC, portrays itself as a social democratic party, that means, you know, looking critically at the well-being of individuals, the New Patriotic Party saying that they have poorly managed the affairs of the country. One of the allegations they leveled against the government, for that matter, President John Dramani Mahama, is that he has been incompetent. Although some infrastructural measures have been put in place with roads and some bridges, the latest one is that circle interchange, they said they have corrupted the system and that a lot of these government officials have enriched themselves to the detriment of the average Ghanaian. And the government has said that it's not true and that these are perceptions. It remains to be seen who will be believed by prospective voters tomorrow.
Now, is there any bad blood between the two leading candidates? I see today that President Mahama has accused the opposition leader of deliberately undermining confidence in the voting process. It's a similar allegation that we heard in the U.S. presidential election.
Well, it's all part of the gamesmanship that they play. I remember 8 years ago when the National Democratic Congress Party was in the opposition, they made similar allegations of connivance of the ruling party at that time, the NPP, with the Electoral Commission to rig the election in their favor. Now the table has turned, and the New Patriotic Party is saying the same thing that they did 8 years ago, telling the National Democratic Congress of defending the Electoral Commission when every Tom, Dick, and Harry is saying the Electoral Commission particularly have not done well in communicating effectively about some of the challenges they face in organizing this election. However, the NPP is saying that all indications are that the Electoral Commission is trying to rig the election in favor of the NDC. However, officials of the Electoral Commission that I spoke with tell me that it's not true and that they constantly engage all political parties at the Inter-Party Advisory Committee level, which is IPAC, where you have representation of all political parties coming to make presentation, and then they unanimously agree on certain procedures to be used during the election, and that those are the same procedures they are using in the process of enforcing the electoral laws in organizing the election show.
And Peter, once the polls are closed and the votes are counted, when do you think a winner will be announced?
The electoral laws do not necessarily say or give the specific time within which the election should be announced. However, the Electoral Commission on its own have said between 48 and 78 hours' time, they should be able to give the outcome or announce the outcome of the election within that period. And it is only the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, who is the presiding officer for the presidential election, who can declare the results of that election.
That's VOA's Peter Clote from Accra, Ghana. He spoke with Joe DiCapua. The fairness of Ghana's polls will be confirmed in part by election observers from a number of sources, including the European Union, ECOWAS, the Catholic Church of Ghana, and the U.S. One of the most prominent U.S. observers is Assistant Secretary of State for Africa Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She says the U.S. has spent $7 million to help support Ghana's democratic process. The money went in part to the Electoral Commission, Peace Commission, and to civil society to support training of national observers and monitors. Thomas-Greenfield told VOA that she met with the Electoral Commission and has confidence in its ability to hold a free and fair election and address any disputes.
We talked about some of the challenges that they are facing and how they are working to address those challenges, to address the questions, to address disinformation, and also to make sure that the voting public has the right information to move forward in the election. I think my biggest concern is that the election process be a peaceful one, and that the candidates call upon their supporters to support them with their vote, not in going into the streets. And any efforts to participate in violence should be called out, and people should be told that they will be held accountable if they use violence to promote themselves and to encourage their supporters.
The press reports that the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, also spoke to both leading candidates a few days ago.
The basis for the phone calls was to encourage both of them and urge both of them to encourage a peaceful process in the election and to make sure that none of their supporters use violence as a means of showing support. They were also both encouraged to sign the peace agreement, and they both did, and we're very pleased about that.
Thomas-Greenfield calls Ghana a beacon of democracy for West Africa and the whole continent. She says all of its elections have been very competitive, and the U.S. is looking forward to working with whoever wins.
Whatever happens in the election, we have a strong relationship with the country and the people of Ghana. We have worked very closely with President Mahama during his tenure, and if he is reelected, we will continue to work with him, and we have worked closely with Nana when he was foreign minister of the country and in previous capacities as the Minister of Justice. And if he should win the election, we look forward to working closely with him as well.
She says she and others will congratulate the winner and encourage the loser to accept graciously and support the country's democracy. Southern Africa's lengthy drought has gotten worse, aid officials say, hitting its peak and affecting 13.8 million people, mainly because of increased need in Madagascar, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Nearly 14 million people are now staring down hunger as the lean season starts in Southern Africa, according to United Nations estimates. These months before the next harvest are critical. Food supplies are critically low because of poor harvests caused by the El Niño weather phenomenon, which has wrought havoc in the region for the past 18 months. Timo Pakala is the El Niño coordinator for the Southern Africa Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
The impact of the El Niño is now really being felt because the harvest was very poor early 2016. Now we are at the peak of the lean season, meaning that we still have some way to go to the next harvest, which is in March, April in most parts of Southern Africa. So this is where people are really at the most stressed in coping with the lack of food and the poor water situation in many parts of Southern Africa.
These food shortages are compounded by poor commodity prices and sluggish economies in the Southern African region, which can hamper government's ability to help by importing food. And a drought does not only hit bellies, the UN notes. In Malawi, some 137,000 children have been forced out of school, many daunted by the prospect of a hungry, thirsty trek to school, only to be followed by a hungry, thirsty day in the classroom. Unlike the mass devastation of a hurricane or earthquake, a drought slowly nibbles away at people's meager food supplies and survival skills. That slow creep, Pakala says, makes it harder to rouse donor funds.
It's a large, bigger challenge to mobilize resources and get the international development partners or organized to support countries like is the case in Southern Africa.
The United Nations says it is facing a funding gap of about $550 million. That money, they say, is the difference between giving millions of people full rations and allowing hundreds of thousands of children to suffer through escalating malnutrition. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Local media report talks continue behind closed doors in Zimbabwe between two of Zimbabwe's largest opposition parties. It says they're trying to unite against President Robert Mugabe and the ruling Zimbabwe African Union Patriotic Front Party for the 2018 elections. Morgan Changarai of the Movement for Democratic Change reportedly is meeting with Joyce Majuru of the Zimbabwe People First Party. Majuru is a former vice president and former member of the ruling party. She fell from grace after being accused of plotting against the president. Mr. Mugabe and ZANU-PF have ruled Zimbabwe for 29 years. UN Women and other groups are using this month to call for an end to violence against women. They're also promoting international and national legislation to protect women and girls and support community efforts to end gender-based abuse. Reporter William Eagle looks at some of the agency's efforts in sub-Saharan Africa.
Women's rights activists say violence comes in many forms, including intimidation, harassment, and rape as a weapon of war. One of the most common is from intimate or family relationships. Statistics tell part of the story. Simone Ellis Oluwatolunya is the Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa for UN Women. She says figures from the African Development Bank show that an estimated 37% of women in sub-Saharan Africa are victims of intimate partner violence. Some research shows a high level of tolerance for wife beating, and some women are among those who support it. UN Women and its partners work to convince the public that domestic violence can no longer be accepted as normal. Oluwatch Olunya cites a World Bank study of women's attitudes on the topic in Guinea and Mali.
The report says 75% of women report acceptance of wife beating. Socially, it's considered a normal practice. In some situations, not all, but in some situations, it is considered an honor, if you like, that your relationship is strong if you are beaten.
Results of the violence are not just physical and psychological, but also economic. Oluwatch Olunya says a report by the African Development Bank showed that in Tanzania, female victims of violence earned between 30 to 40% less income than those who had not suffered domestic abuse.
So you're taking productive people out of the economy. You're building on the cost of health care, of counseling, of the justice system. This all adds up.
Violence against women is not just limited to the home. In an age of democratic elections, intimidation has been used against promising women candidates in Côte d'Ivoire, Kenya, Uganda, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe.
That can be in order to discourage the women to go forward for a position, and also it has happened against voters.
In an effort to solve the problem, UN Women is working with national governments and civil society to set up hotlines for use during the election period. Women and others can call in to alert authorities and activists about areas of potential danger to women.
They're able to immediately call through and report the incident. This goes through to our situation room. And in the situation room, we have a network where support can be deployed immediately to the hotspot area. That would be if it's the police or civil society organizations, what have you.
UN Women is engaged with partners in civil society and with national governments to end gender violence in other ways as well. It works, for example, to pass national legislation and improve policies ensuring justice for women. It also works with local authorities and community leaders, as in this effort described by Oluwatch Olunya.
We are working with the uniformed forces in terms of sensitizing them, giving them clear knowledge and information on what exactly is ending violence against women, what are the existing legislations within the country that will enable them to manage this situation, how it can be documented, and what other areas of support are required for the woman.
In many countries, including Ethiopia and South Africa, UN Women has established shelters where battered women can be safe and find access to medical and legal services. The UN agency also works with men and community leaders to protect women from violence and also from some harmful traditional practices. For example, thousands of young girls each year are harmed while undergoing female circumcision. Others under 18 who are forced to marry are vulnerable to problems during delivery or are at risk of developing fistula. These are tears in the reproductive tract that allow the leakage of body waste, causing pain and often social ostracism. A community leader in Ethiopia who preaches against early marriage and gender-based violence is Archbishop Abune Marcos from the East Gojem Zone Diocese. With the support of UN Women, he has trained more than 300 religious leaders to reject harmful traditional practices and prejudices, some which are justified by what he calls misinterpreted religious principles. Archbishop Marcos says he'd like to help train others in theological schools throughout the country. Education is power and the key to freedom, he says. Development activists agree and add that women's freedom is a crucial part of boosting Africa's development. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
International Criminal Court has begun its first trial against a senior member of the Ugandan Lord's Resistance Army and its first against a former child soldier. The procedures raise complex ethical questions. The defendant, Dominic Ongwen, who has pled not guilty, was both a victim and an alleged perpetrator of the rebel group's brutality. Lisa Bryant reports.
Count one, attacks against the civilian population as such as a war crime on...
The trial against Dominic Ongwen took an unusual turn Monday, as the defendant initially said he did not understand the charges against him. His defense team suggested he was not psychologically fit to stand trial. But presiding judge Bertram Schmidt rejected those claims, and Ongwen was asked whether he pleaded guilty.
In the name of God, I deny all these charges in respect to the war in northern Uganda.
You therefore plead not guilty with respect to all the charges, I assume.
Yes.
Ongwen faces a record 70 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity against him at the Hague-based International Criminal Court. They include rape, murder, torture, pillaging, and enslavement during LRA attacks on camps of displaced people in northern Uganda between 2003 and 2004. He's also accused of many other crimes the ICC is not examining at this particular trial. Ongwen was captured in the Central African Republic in January 2015. If found guilty, he could face life in prison. The ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, said the LRA's brutality blighted the lives of millions of ordinary people. She showed graphic images of slaughtered children after four LRA rampages on Ugandan camps.
Your Honours, the evidence shows that in each case, Dominic Ongwen played a prominent role in the planning and execution of the four attacks. He did so as a commander of one of the four principal operational units of the LRA, the Senior Brigade.
But Ongwen was also a victim of the LRA, abducted by the rebels at the age of 10 as he walked to school. The defense team will seize on his background in its argument. At the trial's opening, Ongwen blamed the brutalities on LRA leader Joseph Kony, who faces an ICC arrest warrant and is still on the run. Leslie Lefkow, Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, says the group has also called on the court to expand its investigation to LRA atrocities committed outside Uganda.
We also, by the way, have called upon the ICC to investigate abuses committed by the Ugandan military during its long war with the LRA, because we and others have documented serious crimes on that side.
The Ongwen trial comes after several African countries said they could withdraw from the court. But in the case of Gambia, where longtime President Yahya Jammeh was defeated in last week's election, the incoming president says he is committed to remaining in the court. And South Africa's opposition has launched a legal effort to block government efforts to withdraw from the ICC. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Fidel Castro ruled Cuba for 47 years, leaving an imprint on almost every major revolutionary effort in Africa after 1959. Join us for an in-depth look at Castro's impact on Africa. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.